Good afternoon. All right, try it again. Good afternoon. Welcome to Tech Ed 2014. Everybody having a good time so far? Awesome. It's Monday morning. We're going to start you guys off with an exam prep, 7410 and 7417, installing and configuring Windows Server 2012 with R2. My name is Alfred Ojukwu. I am a Microsoft consultant. I work out of the New York, New Jersey region with MCS. I do a lot of work with large enterprises, both commercial, mostly financial, helping them out with desktop deployments, desktop management, and of course, a lot of the work includes Windows Server and Windows Server deployment and management using the tools that are available for them. So I do a lot of work internally helping other Microsoft consultants, other Microsoft resources get caught up in exam programs for Exam Connect. Many of you guys probably have user groups where you guys get together and study different technologies. We do it internally. I'm one of the lead guys internally that work on that sort of initiative internally, and we're trying to look to expand it to the external network so that you can get things like Exam Connect Jeopardy for you guys and different sort of games that you guys can actually play. I won't be able to show it to you today, but if you come up and ask me afterwards, I might be able to share a few things with you. I have a blog site, thedevicepros.com. If you're interested, check it out. We're talking about all the new things in terms of devices. Obviously, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Just check it out. My cohort, some of you may know him, Frank Pinto. We do a lot of work in terms of device management and talking about the things that are coming with the new devices. How many people remember the crew? Woo! Yeah, awesome. You guys, kudos. And everybody else, too. You guys are cool, too. All right, so just quick before I pass the baton over, session objectives. Our goal today is to make sure we give you a certification overview. We want to make sure you're prepared for the exam and understand what is in the exam per section and what they're testing you on. We'll be able to describe some of the key functionalities needed to pass the 7410 exam objectives and just prepare you just to be more effective and more ready to see what's expected on an exam in terms of what's changed with Server 2012 R2. And again, with what you'll see as we go through this is a lot of it still has a lot of the same flavor we had with 2012, but a few components have been added in with R2, and I'll talk about those when we get there. And again, we want to identify areas that may require a little bit more focus for you in order to pass the exam. Hopefully, if you have any questions, please save them to the end because I believe we're jam-packed with information. I'm going to try my best to make sure I cover as much as possible. However, I'm going to lose some of my time to David Alfassi. Folks, give a hand clap for David Alfassi.
That this session will be full of technical information, lots and lots of technical information. But first, I want to make sure that everybody has a good understanding of the certification program and some of the things that's involved in the certification questions. So Alfred is really going to discuss Windows Server 2012 content that's in the exam. I'm going to discuss a little bit more about the certification components of the exam, such as the number of questions, the passing score, stuff that really you might not be familiar with, or stuff that has changed if it's been a really long time you haven't taken a certification exam. So can I first have a show of hands here? Who here has passed or taken a Microsoft certification exam before? All right, the large majority of you, perfect. Now, out of those people that have taken a certification exam, who has taken a certification exam within the last 2 years? All right, about half of those people, great. So things have changed. Certification program at Microsoft has changed drastically. And if you've taken an exam 5 years ago and then an exam within the last 24 months, you've seen some of those changes. And I'm going to discuss some of those changes now. Now, first of all, I just want to bring it back in terms of the benefits of certification. So when we talk about the benefits of certification, there are many. And one of the things that employers are looking for today is these true relevant certifications. And what we've done at Microsoft is really ensure that the certifications are relevant to your job tasks. So one of the efforts that we've made is ensuring that the questions actually ask you about things that you do in your daily job. We don't ask esoteric questions about mimical environments that may exist in those painted forests that are purple. We don't do that. We create scenarios of environments that exist, that are real, that you encounter. So you cannot, you don't have to worry about going to take an exam and encountering questions that really are not real or may not be relevant to you. So feel free to have that confidence when you go and take an exam. And that makes that certification much more relevant from an employment standpoint as well. And so that's true for your career, for yourself, in terms of your confidence. Once you have that certification, you feel a little bit more confident going and tackling those complex environments. Now, some of those changes. The rigor is probably the most change that you might be happy or unhappy about. If you've taken an exam recently, I get people that tell me all the time, you know what, I went to take an exam not too long ago, and I walked in and I wasn't prepared. And a few years ago, I went to take an exam and I wasn't prepared, and I passed. And this time, I did not pass. I was shocked at how complex and difficult the questions were. And you can expect that because Microsoft has done a full push ensuring that we're fighting piracy, people that pirate content, fight them all the time, ensuring, again, that relevance of that content. And another way that we ensure that relevance is by making sure that those questions are really difficult. We fight something called gaming. We don't want people to be able to guess the answer to the questions. And we do that by ensuring that the wrong answers look really, really good. And, you know, for people who write exam questions, they'll tell you the most difficult thing about writing an exam question is getting the wrong answers. That's a very challenging thing to do, and there's a strong effort in there. So rigor is one of those things that we've pushed very hard for. Recertification, you can expect that there will be recertification requirements every 3 years. So once a certification that you've taken will be based on a specific technology, well, that technology retires, you need to refresh those certification. So there will be recertification requirements as well. And Microsoft announces all those changes on their blog, which is the Born to Learn blog. So if you ever look for the Born to Learn blog, you can access a lot of information of Microsoft certification. The MCSE is back. If you've had a certification on NT40, you may remember the MCSE, Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer. Well, that term was removed, and now it's the Microsoft Certified Solutions Expert is what the MCSE stands for. We also have the MCSA, which is the first level of certification, Solutions Associate. The MCSA will be the first level of certification that you can attain with Microsoft with passing anywhere from 2 or 3 exams. And those are targeted to a specific technology. For example, you could be an MCSA on Windows Server 2012. 410, the exam we're talking about today, is the first exam in that track, in that MCSA Windows Server 2012 track. There's also developer certifications, and the MCSD is one of them. And again, those are tracks that require 3 to 7 exams for the largest MCSE track. Increased rigor, as I mentioned, is a big change not only in content but also in item types. The exam 410 does not include case studies. However, other exams do. A case study will be a long scenario that would kind of mimic an environment where you walk into a company, ask them a whole lot of information about their environment, and they give you all that information, and then after that you need to answer 10 short questions. So that is a case study. You might find those in later exams, typically MCSE exams. You also have build lists, where you have to put steps in a specific order. You also have drag and drop, where you need to drag server objects into a specific subnet or in a specific Active Directory site. So you have these type of interactive questions that, again, help you mimic that real environment, but also make the questions a little bit more difficult. So some tips. First of all, you should know some of the exam basics. Exams, certification exams, all have anywhere between 40 to 60 questions. The majority of them fall in the low 50s. You have, most exams take about 1.5 hours. That's the time that you can expect. If you're a non-native English speaker, you can actually request for more time. Some exams can take longer. We have beta exams that will go all the way to 4 hours, but the majority of them will take you about 90 minutes. The passing score is always 700, and I get the question a lot, is what does 700 mean? Well, it's roughly 70%, but it means something different depending on which exam you take. Every exam is weighted at 700, so every exam has that 700 passing score. However, for some exams, it means you need 26 questions right. For another exam, you need 22 questions right. It depends. They're weighted differently, but it will always be 700. When you finish your exam, you will get a result report that will tell you which sections of the exam you scored how much or how well you did with a progress bar. So how to interpret a question? Every question, lucky for you, are built the same way. We want to create an environment where you're tested on the content, on your knowledge of the product, rather than your ability to answer a question, rather than your ability to do reading comprehension. It's really about the content. So every question has the same setup. First, you have a business problem, laying it all out for you. What's the environment? Then you have a goal statement. Every single question will always have the same three words. You need to. So this is my environment. You have 500 Windows 8 computers. You have 5 offices. You have a perimeter network and you have an internal network. You have 2 Active Directory sites. This is your environment. You have a business problem. You want to upgrade to Windows Server 2012. And then you have a you need to statement. You need to install Windows Server 2012 as fast as possible. It's always a you need to statement. And then what should you do? Your correct answer, your incorrect answers. And that's your anatomy of a question. So if you look for those components, think always that we're going from big to small, big environment, specific goal, and then your answers and questions. Your answers and incorrect answers, sorry. All right? Any questions so far? Questions about the questions? No. All right. One important myth that we want to relay out to you guys that is not true is we're not trying to trick you. Microsoft is not trying to trick you in exam questions. The goal of certification is to ensure that the people that are unqualified fail. But more importantly, the people that are qualified must be able to pass. When somebody is qualified with the technology and they fail an exam, we fail in our certification. Because we want to ensure that if you're qualified, you must pass that exam. If you're unqualified, we want you to fail. So tricking someone usually means you're tripping out the qualified people. And we don't want that. Okay? So, no tricky. So again, each exam, each question is worth a positive point. You never get negative points for getting something wrong. All right, so you'll never have points subtracted to you in your score. So don't be afraid to guess. If you don't know, don't leave a question blank. Just guess. It's better than leaving the answer blank. All right, and I promise I was only going to take 10 minutes, so I'm going to pass the bar next to Alfred, who will cover the details of exam 410. Thank you.
All right, let's give a clap for David. Thank you, David, for that time. Again, I think the information he provided you is going to be key as you prepare for the exam because it really does, you know, make a difference when you get in that exam room and you understand how to actually take an exam. It's not just about answering the questions correctly. It's understanding how to get the answers correctly and what it means in terms of the result. So as we dig into this, I'm going to apply some of the details of what David mentioned as it relates to some of the test exam questions we have in here. All right, so this is 7410 and 7417. Again, the majority of the conversation is around 7410, but if you are looking to do an upgrade, 7417 is the exam that you want to take. I think David mentioned this a little bit earlier. Again, if you're upgrading Server 2008, you can basically do that by taking the 7417 if you already have your MCSC. For those of you that are brand new, we'll go in with the 7410 and we'll talk about what the components are. So in terms of percentage, you kind of see here, it was 17%, but now they changed it to 15 to 20%. Each of these are a component of what will be covered in the exam objectives. Now, keep in mind, we only have about an hour, which is a lot of time, but enough time to kind of cover a lot of concepts, and hopefully we'll be able to get through each one of these sections and answer, you know, not necessarily detailed questions, but something that might help you as you prepare to take the exam. So we'll start with installing, configuring servers, configuring server roles and features. We'll go into a little bit about Hyper-V, configuring Hyper-V, what's required there, and we'll do a little demo on that when we get to that section so that you kind of have a chance to see it. Now, many of you probably have already done some of this work already. This is 7410. This is the introductory exam. And as you go into 7411, which we'll cover after this, and then 7412, which is the advanced configuration of Windows Server 2012, the details of how these things are configured will be covered at that time. However, this is the introductory, so you'll be able to see what it looks like. We'll go on to deploying and configuring core network services, which talks about, you know, DNS, DHCP, and all those requirements around what, how I make my networks work. And then we'll talk about installing and administering Active Directory with some of the new features. And lastly, we'll talk about creating and managing group policies. Now, I had one gentleman come up and ask me the question around, will this cover Windows Server 2012 R2? The answer is yes, right? So if you took the exam prior to January, you probably didn't have to worry about the R2 components. You didn't have to worry about work folders. You didn't have to worry about, you know, QoS. But it's important to make sure that you know what those are, because as you're going through the exam and you're preparing, you want to understand what those terms are. We'll cover that as well. All right, so the first section, installing and configuring configuring servers. Now, if you did a quick Bing and you went to 7410, or you did a search for 7410, it would take you to the exam site, which basically has all the details, covers it section by section as to what you can actually look to see during the exam preparation. I'm hoping to give you tips and tricks. Here's the first section, covering installation of servers, configuring servers, things like server core, remote servers, things of that nature, and local storage, working with disk, and a little bit about storage and storage spaces, but more around disk management. With install servers, there are no changes with R2. The install process is just the same. We'll see a few changes with configuring servers, and then configuring local storage, there are no changes as well other than storage spaces. It's funny because this session actually covers a lot of information that you guys will probably hear throughout the week, which is really cool. However, in order to get the details of each specific thing, make sure you're taking note of that concept or that topic and finding out what sessions are being delivered during Tech Ed so that you can actually get a chance to absorb the full detail of what that component really is describing. So we start off with the OS servers and licensing. We talk about the different types of servers that are available in 2012. They basically slimmed it down to four different versions. We have data center, standard, essentials, and foundations. Four different servers. Now, if you're in the enterprise space, you probably see just data center and standard. That's typically what you'll probably end up seeing. And essentials and foundations are much, for the small business units, basically where essentials gives you the ability to have up to 25 users on the, you know, managing on that server, and then the foundations, which is a much smaller space of 15 users. Now, this also talks about the differences in licensing. Basically, they're exposed from the standard in the data center based on the physical or virtual instances that each support. Again, that's the licensing difference. You can see here that who knows what a POSE is, really quick? POSE. So physical operating system environment and virtual operating system environments. You can either run it in one or the other. So as you're going into the exam room, think about the scenario in which one type of server will run in one instance and the other in the other. So a good example is Foundation. You can only run it as a physical operating system or as a virtual operating system in order to stay in compliance with the license. And again, that's for small businesses. And Foundation, you can only run it in a physical operating system environment. Now, standard and all that, there is no limitation except for with the standard, you can only have two instances running on a virtual machine. And then with the data center, which is what most people usually run with, they're looking for the maximized number of virtual machines running in their data center. So typically in large data centers, you're going to see data center being hence the word data center, right? So you're basically able to run it on that component. But just know that those are the four different instances. However, don't forget about the other options. You have Windows Hyper-V, storage, and multipoint servers. Now, you don't necessarily have to know those as it is more important to know data center, standard, foundations, and essentials. Those are the key elements. However, those are also components of Windows Server 2012 that you probably want to make sure that you're aware of. And a lot of these different roles are upgradable from the existing Windows Server 2008 environment. They map directly as we go into it. Now, Windows Server 2012 limits. So in comparison, we start seeing that we can classify them in three different categories. We have the foundations I mentioned earlier, the essentials, and the standard data center. Now, processor limit starts off basically letting you know that with the data center, you can have up to 64 processors. That's pretty much the way to go most of the time. And then with the RAM, you have the 4 terabyte limit on the data center and the 32 gigs on the foundation, which is much smaller. I mentioned the max users as well for the foundations and all the way up to the unlimited max users. Again, when you're in the exam room and they're asking you to decide on which server or which type of server to use for which remote office location, think about these options. Think about what you're trying to do. A good example is Active Directory Certificate Services. Now, you can only have it as a certificate authority on a foundation or essential server. In other words, you won't be able to run the web enrollment on a foundation or essential server, for example. Or for example, file services limits. You'll be able to run a standalone DFS route, but you won't be able to do anything else in terms of having a full-blown out DFS solution. Typically, those are available in the case that you need to do a migration or manage data from one server to another. Those opportunities are available to use those components. When you first start the install, you'll usually see this screen, and I would have loved to have that screen show up on my demo, but one of the machines aren't working, but we'll do another demo later on if I can get the other system going. The default installation component on a Windows Server 2012 installation is Core. Core is not a standard server type. It's a server, it's basically a server, a way to install a server component. So you can have Windows Server 2012 install as a Core installation or a GUI installation. A Core is a much thinner, lighter lighter instance of Windows Server 2012. There are a number of benefits that you see with it. For example, reduce disk space, reduce patch frequency. You don't have to patch it as often. And just basically reduces the attack surface, just eliminating the need to have that open, unnecessary services running on that server. So does anybody know, can you install Core and then convert it back to a GUI? Yeah. You guys are going to pass the exam. Awesome. So that's pretty much that is essentially what they want to know. Do you understand when you can use Core and when you can't? How you can manage Core and when you can't? And so installation requirements for Windows Server 2012, these again are what we consider the lower limits. We talk about the 1.4 gigs, 512 megs of RAM are required. Again, this is just to make sure that the largest number of users can actually take benefit of Windows Server 2012. So these numbers are pretty much, the standard of what we start with. With Server 2008, I believe 1024 is 768. It's been raised to 768, but before it was 800 by 600, which is a lower VGA setting, but now it's 1024 768, so something to keep in mind. And also with internet access is also a requirement. Now, I don't know, if you're in a lab environment, how many people really need an internet access other than to register the actual key that they're looking for? So just something to think about. These are minimum requirements. Then again, we have the supported maximums. I mentioned a little of this earlier. We talk about the logical processors for Server 2012 versus 2008. The numbers go up tremendously, and the RAM and the number of supported failover clusters actually go up tremendously as well. Now, this number could have slightly changed with Server 2012 R2. This is a slide we had from with 2012. But just make sure that you know what those limits are. Those limits haven't changed for the basic configurations. Features on demand is one of the selling points of having Server Core. The ability to remove features on your server whenever you don't need it. So basically that data is stored at the local, located on C Windows, the WinSSX SX, I can never say that, right? SXS, I got it. It allows you to have all of the installation components for any install that you want to have of a feature or role on that system. You know, as probably many of you as admins have probably worked with this, having it installed in a local machine somewhere else and being able to install a different component by calling that location. So basically, you can add and remove features later as needed, and you can use commands. So the basic commands, like you mentioned, install Windows feature or uninstall Windows feature, are just some of the basic commands. Of course, there's a lot more. And you start seeing that you can use it across different solutions. Like if you see here, we have the ability to use it in DISM. DISM, which I'll talk about in a few, also gives you the ability to install and remove features as needed. And you can also work with offline installation of features on VHDs and VHDX files as well. Here's a sample file that basically talks about installing a feature with Windows Features on Demand. And again, in the exam, understand what they're asking you to do. If they're asking you about a feature like remote desktop services and you need to install it using a command line, know what that command line is, or at least a basic understanding of it. Use the PowerShell window to do a get help and find out what that command is, what, you know, how it actually relates to installing a feature that you're looking to have running on that system. A little bit about Windows Server 2012 Server Core. I just want to mention the sconfig. How many people know what sconfig is? It's a server config. Awesome. Right. So that is not deprecated. You can still use that. That's still a valid term. So, you know, it basically allows you to be able to configure the server as needed, but you have to be an admin. You have to be in an admin group to be able to do that. So the key here is those commands are still available. It's probably what you'll use in your server core installation. However, you can use other commands like WinRM to actually do some work on that server and make changes as needed. So again, we mentioned it goes from 12 different roles to 19. When we're going from server 2008 to 2012, and you see a number of roles that aren't available in server 2012 core. And we have Active Directory Federation Services. I don't have to go through the list, but here, just there are a number of reasons why these roles aren't going to be available in a server core installation. Fax services, volume activation services, Windows deployment services. Again, I share this with you because when you're going into the exam room, think about what's not going to be available. If I install a server core, it won't be able to run WDS. If I install a server core, it won't be able to run remote desktop services on it, right? So that then you have to figure out, what do I have to do to make sure that I can actually run server 2012? I'm going to do an install of the server GUI. Again, I have here an uninstall. If I want to convert it to a server core, I can do the uninstall. But if I'm going to make it an actual GUI of a server 2012, I'm going to do the exact opposite and run the install and make that available on the system. You will be tested on that sort of information. Make sure that you're thinking about it and you understand what those commands are and what runs on a server core instance. So continuing forward, we have the deployment services and image management. How many people do desktop deployments? So desktop deployments. Again, the cool thing is this. You know, I've always used DISM for desktop management. But clearly, I've had customers that have also used it for server deployment and server management. It does the same thing, whether it's a client or a server, but it's a great tool to use. I've just listed two of my favorite commands, kind of saying, know these. These are cool commands. I've used that 1,000 times where, when you install, Windows Server 2012, you have to enable those features, understand what those features are doing. Again, I mentioned that earlier. Another key thing to remember, there are going to be a number of different tools that they ask you about. Make sure you know what those tools are. A good example is ImageX. ImageX was a previous tool used for imaging that is now deprecated with Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. It's been replaced with DISM, as you can see here. And the key here is that you can actually do a little bit more with DISM. It's basically combined a lot of the roles that ImageX had and added it to DISM so that you can actually do Windows installations with DISM as well as offline and online management of an image as needed. So ImageX is still usable, but it's been deprecated, and If you're asked to choose between DISM and ImageX, I would probably select DISM. Just saying, I do it. So, okay. Configuring servers. So after you've gone through the process of installing Server 2012 and you've set up everything the way you want it to work, you're going to have to think about these areas: configuring the network connection, setting the time zone, enabling remote desktop management, renaming the computer, right? Because it gives it that long, funky SID every single, not SID, but the address that you're supposed to sort of decode and figure out what it means, if it ever means anything. And then you're going to be asked to join a domain as well, if you're joining it to domain, or if you're just using it as a test lab. So these are just some things that you'll have to do in addition. Again, posting this just to say, think about the process. As you're going through the exam, they're going to want to know, do you understand how I can go from an ISO image of Windows Server 2012 up to the point where I have the installation done, and what things do I have to do after that installation is complete? So that kind of talks about that area. Then we go into configuring the NICs, right? We have NIC teaming. Again, this is an area that's somewhat new with Server 2012 R2. We start talking about what's required in NIC teaming. Configuring NIC teaming in virtual machines. We have three different modes in Server 2012. Well, technically, there's two: switch independent and switch dependent, right? So switch independent, basically, the incoming traffic comes through one card, and all the network adapters are connected to a different switch, providing it just basically the path to talk to that switch on its own. There's no aggregation of information. And it's usually needed to use, you have to use the Hyper-V port or the dynamic port to be able to do that. But basically, when you do the switching, the NIC teaming, you basically end up with an aggregated team that basically manages the network communication across that one virtual team device. Switch dependent mode, which incorporates both static teaming or LACP, or just link aggregated, link aggregation control protocol. That's a mouthful. Hopefully you won't get that one on the test. But LACP, it's where the host switch agrees as to networks are actually part of it, what actually NICs are part of it. So you have the option of selecting switch independent and the static teaming or LACP. The static teaming or LACP requires additional hardware. So most of the time when you're configuring those NICs, you're going to see that the switch independent is what's being selected and what's being used when you're configuring your NICs. Here's a good example of what it looks like as you're walking through that process. You're going to team it. You're going to use the teaming option to decide what you want on your network, and then also I mentioned the address hash versus the Hyper-V port, with deciding how that communication is going to happen through the load balancing. So the address hash divides the traffic by IP address or ports or whatever you want to call it, and the Hyper-V balancing mode, basically a load balancing mode, divides the traffic based on the virtual machine that you're actually using, right? So then it knows exactly which path it needs to go to. But there are some features, there are some solutions that don't necessarily take advantage of that. But it basically allows you to manage that traffic as it goes through. Now with Server 2012 R2, there's a load balancing mode called dynamic. So that's included it's another mode that moves network streams between network cards, and that's available in 2012 R2 only. Now in the image I have here, you don't see it there, but that dynamic is also an option as well. Again, I'll probably say this 1,000 times: PowerShell, PowerShell, PowerShell. Everything that we're doing today has a PowerShell underlying script, command line that you need to input in. Things like, how do I team using a PowerShell command? Here's a good example: new net LLBFO team, and then I can actually use teaming mode for link aggregated to make NIC 1 and NIC 2 talk using the Hyper-V ports on the same network. So again, that's a big deal. Again, if you're looking for more information and you want to find details around where those commands are, you can do a get command dash module at net LLBFO. Anybody know what LBFO? I never did figure this one out.
Load
Oh, I was like, I couldn't figure out the FO. I was like, what's FO? Well, now I know. LBFO. I think it's really cool to have that. And then the other piece is the, just kind of showing you what it looks like, what you'll see in there once you've been enabled. You'll see NIC teaming enabled. By default, when you have your servers installed, you probably won't have that on unless you run a PowerShell command or go through the process of using the server manager to do it. You won't be able to see it. Okay, so we're going to Windows disk settings. Now, I'm trying to take my time going through this because, again, this is a lot of material for an exam. The exam takes probably more than 2 hours, depending on how much time you spend on it. But this is good information to know. Think about your disk settings. Once you have your server up and running, what do I need to do to make sure I have the right disk configuration? We're getting into the area of talking about the disk type and the storage type, which also comes up as a question, right? So we have two different partition styles. The MBR partition style, which was the older format, and then the GPT, which is a newer format. So MBR was basically, if anyone, I did a session last year on UEFI BIOS, but the MBR, MBR basically is it's a limited version of what was provided in terms of disk partitioning, and it supported up to four different partitions, and it was a much smaller component. It only could support up to 2 terabytes. And it was limited in what it could actually do. So most of the basic disks that you see now, the basic disks that you see on your systems are MBR disks. And many of the new systems that are being built, released, are going to come with the GPT, which has a much larger maximum partition size. So you're going from 2 terabytes to 9.4 zettabytes. Again, I don't think anyone will probably get to that size. I mean, I maybe in a couple years. Or a couple, I don't know how long, but that's pretty big when it comes to partition size. And you can have up to 128 partitions. So you're going from MBRs, which have four partitions, three partitions and an extended partition, to 128 different partitions. Actually, you don't even call them partitions. They're volumes, right? So with MBRs or disks, with GPTs, they're actually actual volumes on that disk itself. And each volume is basically a carved up, it's managed by GUIDs. Again, a little bit more information you probably need. We'll cover some of that in 7411 when we get there. Also think about your divide, what you need to do when you're dividing your disk into partitions. What type of partitions am I building? Am I using a simple, a spanned, a striped, mirrored, RAID 5, RAID 1, RAID 10? Again, these are all components that are going to be built into it, and you'll see that as I think I have a slide or two that talks a little bit more about that. And then the format of the partition. Once I have those partitions with that volume, what kind of format do I want it to have in? NTFS, FAT32, FAT16, and then the new one, REFS. Anybody know what benefits REFS provides? Anybody know? So, REFS provides it basically takes away the need to have to worry about a recovery. It's that much more resilient. You don't have to worry about the recovery process. It's built into it. It's a much more it's a basically new format that's available with Server 2012. REFS does not include support for NTFS features such as file compression, EFS, and disk quotas. So you can't use it for those. They also cannot be read by any operating system older than Windows Server 2012. So just a few things about REFS. Again, thinking about this when you're taking the exam and you're being asked about what type of formatted partition I want to use, make sure you know what those options are. Again, working with disks, we have creating and mounting VHDs. Again, this is something that you probably just have to understand. If I'm going to mount a VHD, where am I going to do it? How do I do it through Server Manager? How do I have access to it or Computer Manager when I want to access it? And this is all the new disk virtualization technology. And part of it goes into storage spaces and storage layouts. So storage pools. I don't have a sudden, but just to talk about it a second here. But storage pools are a big component that are being we're seeing a lot more of that in Windows Server 2012 R2. It's the ability to aggregate a number of disks into a set of pools and make those available so that you can actually carve out different disks or volumes so that they can be presented as load balance disks to an operating system or a VM. Basically, when you add storage, now you can have SSDs or regular HDDs available and have the data sort of flow back and forth depending on what type of data is being written to the disk. So storage pools is a huge piece that gets asked, that you're going to start seeing in the exams. And just making sure that you understand what those are and how they work are going to be very helpful as well. So using Server Manager, you're going to take advantage of the disk management snap-in and also just determine your storage layout. Again, remember, you're going to use storage pools to create, you're going to add disks to the storage pool, and then from after you've added the disks to the storage pool, you're going to create the volumes that you're looking for, and then you're going to format the volumes that you're looking for as well. And the other thing about storage pools is that you can actually expand. If you need to add more disks to it, you can actually expand it and add more disks to it. Okay, key things to remember. So we just covered the first section. Key tips to remember. Windows Server 2012, 64-bit only, right? There's no 32-bit. If you get asked questions around 64 versus 32-bit, remember, 32-bit, sorry, 64-bit only. And versions and additions and the differences. We talked about the fact that you have Windows Server 2012 all the way with the foundations all the way to the data center and the essentials. If you're not working with the other two, essentials or foundations, get familiar with it. Just know what they do. Know why you would use them and what scenario that would come into play. Know what things are not in the core, right? We mentioned the fax, services. Remote desktop services aren't available. Active Directory Federation services. All those are going to be things that they're going to be asking you about. If I need to install a machine, can I install it in the core or not? Well, if they don't have those services, you won't be able to install them on there. Disk partition types. I mentioned that a little bit, just knowing the difference between MBR and GPT when you'd use one versus the other. When I would configure it for NTFS versus FAT32 or FAT16. And NIC teaming, so switch independent versus switch dependent, static versus using a static or LACP for actual NIC teaming. When you'd actually, if they're asking a question about hardware and NIC teaming, you're probably going to select the switch dependent, which is the static or LACP. If there's no question around hardware, you're going to stick with the switch independent. NIC teaming, right? And then lastly, DISM. Again, DISM is your friend. I'm going to tell you that every time. DISM is your friend. Think about that. All right. Keep going. So, practice question. You guys get a break. You guys actually have. I would ask somebody to volunteer, but he's over there on his laptop. I'll read the question. That's all right. Which of the following are valid reasons why administrator might not want to install their Windows Server 2012 servers using the server core options? How many people think it's A? What happened? Did I? Which of the following are valid reasons why administrators might want to install their Windows Server? Yeah. Oh, darn. At least you guys are paying attention. So, which of the following are valid reasons why administrators might want to install their Windows Server 2012 servers using the server core options? How many people think it's A? How many people think it's B? This is going to be hard because it's choose all that apply. How many think it's C? How many think it's all of them? All right. So, A, a server core installation can be converted to the full GUI without reinstalling the operating system. That's correct. B, the PowerShell 3.0 interface in Windows Server includes more than 10 times as many commandlets as PowerShell 2.0. That is also correct, right? We go on. The new server manager in Windows Server 2012 makes it far easier to administer servers remotely. That's true, right? I mean, with WinRM, you can do a lot more. And the last one, which I thought was the interesting one, all Windows Server, that one's not correct. All Windows Server 2012 servers, core licenses cost significantly less than full GUI licenses. There is no cost difference between core and server, right? It's the same, core and GUI. It's the same price, same solution. So, yeah, 3 out of 4 was correct. Some of you guys got it correct. Some of you didn't. Good luck. All right, let's move forward. Next section is covering configure server roles and features. So this is 15 to 20% of the exam. Now, in this exam, in this section, there are a few sections that are different. I'm just going to mention it to you guys so that you know it. So this section covers work folders, which is a new feature in Windows Server 2012 R2. And it also covers managing no non-domain joined servers. So those are the new components that you're going to see that you may not have seen prior to the existing Server 2012 exam for 7410. So we'll talk through most of this. So we'll start off with the configuring file shares. So key tips to know for the exam. So file shares, when do I need to use them? You know what? In other words, are they network only? Or how do I go about configuring it so that I can actually do what I need to on the systems? The first line of defense is your file shares, making sure that you actually have those permissions on those file shares put in place and that you know who's actually accessing them. Again, this is a no-brainer for many of you guys. You probably use it today. And you have options to read, change, full control, folders only, and make changes as needed on those drives as well. And you have options to do it to the folders only. I wouldn't do file shares or file permissions to a drive. In other words, if I have a C or a D drive, I wouldn't necessarily put a folder permission on it. And again, I'm not saying that that's a question you'll get asked, but just think about when they're asking you to do file shares, where you would actually do those file shares. Other things to be aware about when you're talking about file shares is effective permissions. What are the permissions that are being applied to that end user system when I'm going through that process? What is it that they're actually getting? And what happens when I add multiple group memberships? Do I end up with a deny at some point because they don't have access to a specific file share? What happens at that point? So there are a number of pieces that come up in the exam. And another one that I think is interesting, I'm going to jump straight down to it, is the configuring access-based enumeration, or better known as Abe, right? How many people are familiar with who Abe is? Not Abe Lincoln, but Abe. Right, so Abe is a really cool feature because basically all you're saying to the user that's asking for the permissions is, I'm going to only let you see what you're allowed to see, or what you have permissions to see. Everything else will be hidden from you, right? So it's a really slick way of making sure that they have access to the right information. And this isn't a new feature. This has been around since Windows Server 2003. However, for some reason, it's now being sort of pronounced a little bit more because of the whole idea around security and security management. So make sure you know what Abe is and how it works and why it matters. Make sure you know the difference between share permissions and NTFS permissions, right? Share permissions are for network permissions on a network, making sure people have access to a share folder on a network. And NTFS permissions are for access to a local disk or a local system. But you can still access, once you get over to the local system from a network share, you'll still need access to that local disk or drive that you're actually sharing out, or folder. Again, you see a lot of this in DFS. The next 7411 goes into a bit more details in terms of configuring Windows Server 2012 and also talks about a lot more around DFS and what's required on there. In this exam, it's more focused on understanding what those file share permissions basic, those file share permissions are and why they matter. And the other piece is knowing the difference between the basic permissions and the advanced permissions. So basically, the basic permissions are basically a subset of advanced permissions that are pre-configured for you by the actual server configuration itself. And advanced permissions, if you want to give more granular permissions, you can go in there and do the same thing as well. And that's been added there. A few other things to know about the file shares. Are we good on time? A few other things to know about the file shares. I'm not keeping up with time anymore. I give up. Is, we usually have a clock, but I don't have one, is configuring offline files, disk quotas, and volume shadow copy. These are different areas that are covered in the exam. Configuring offline files goes back to, you know, having offline files, or what we call client-side caching, where you have files available on the local machine so that if you're off on the, you know, network, you're off the network and you're at home, you can actually have your files available when you're not in the office or, you know, on the network. Those files are available. You can configure it so that certain files that are networked are available on your local machine. It's a very good sync mechanism across devices. And you can also control this through group policy. There are group policies that actually allow you to control who has access to offline files on their systems. I tend to not be a huge fan of offline files, mainly because at some point when I have a number of systems, you can see all these systems, all the data is trying to replicate across all the systems. So it's very similar to, I would say, work folders or SkyDrive, which I prefer more because, again, that's managed. Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks. Somebody just corrected me. Yeah. Yeah, the place formerly known as SkyDrive. We have a lot of that. And the disk quotas. So making sure disk quotas are becoming also a big piece of this as well. Make sure that you understand how to configure disk quotas. In other words, just limiting disk usage, you know, making sure that you're conserving space. If you're dealing with anything like user profile management or file storage resource management, disk quotas are also important. Knowing how to set it up so that you either have a soft or a hard configuration and determining when you can actually set a hard limit so that users don't use more of the quota than they're actually allowed to use. And when you need to expand it, you can actually have templates available for disk quotas as well. The other piece that you want to be familiar with is volume shadow copy. Again, this is useful for, again, VM snapshots or server backups or file recovery. I would have a volume shadow copy just if I needed to be able to restore a VM that's needed, and I just have that data kind of copied off and available if I have a file that I need to pull back later on. It's available through a volume shadow copy, and it's run on the volume shadow services. And you can have previous versions of files, as I mentioned, and servers, and if you accidentally delete or overwrite the file, you'll be able to pull it back if you have that volume shadow copy available on that system. So let's go into a little bit about another one of my favorite features with Server 2012, work folders. Again, very similar to OneDrive, but it's for the corporate environment. Basically allows you to configure your systems so that you can actually access files on your network on any device that's joined or not joined to the domain, right? So it also allows you to synchronize the data across those systems. When you're setting it up on the server side, you can have multiple sync shares per server. Each share maps to a file system location. And the key to remember is that the users are subject to a single share. Now, you won't get, I can probably guarantee that they won't ask you this level of detail of work folders. They want to know if you understand what it means. They want to know that if you understand when it needs to be configured and when you would actually use it. So understand what the basic functionality is and when you'd use that over things like offline files or things like network shares that are just used for file shares, and when work folders would actually become relevant and important for you to use. Just a quick high-level configuration of what work folders looks like. Again, very simple. You have a reverse proxy that's available, and the file server that's internal that basically allows access to the internal environment, and the user devices can come through Active Directory and authenticate using one of the solutions that are available up there. And you can set it up using the device management policy and have things like, you know, file encryption, selective wipe, you know, have them require password. Any of those options are available. But basically, those file servers are available and shared amongst anyone that has access to work folders. You also have data management across a number of systems. Time is flying. All right, let's keep going. So configuring print and document servers. I'm not going to go too much into detail with this. Again, the things to remember about this is understanding the different types of printer configurations that I would want to have. You know, the fact that you have printer device management, printer server management, and you can have direct versus network printing. Another key one is consider remote desktop easy print, which is basically being able to configure the server, the print to happen across the network. All right, let's keep going. Somebody just gave me a quick reminder of the time. Again, there's a lot in this exam, so I'm going to go a little bit quicker, but I'm going to try to be as efficient as possible. Things to remember about this section. Volume shadow services, very important. Understand the difference between basic and advanced permissions. Remote management, again, deeply encouraged because, again, with Server Manager, you can manage multiple servers across the infrastructure. And don't forget about quotas. Again, I mentioned a little bit about storage pools. If there's a couple sessions here at TechReady that you want to attend, that should be one of them, right? And the other one I'm going to mention, it's not on here, it's called Windows Intune. Check it out. Practice question. This one's, I'll just read it real quick. You create a volume on disk one in the server and create a shared volume on that volume. You want to enable the volume shadow copy service on the shared folder. What steps can you take to accomplish it? So it's not going to be one. I'm just going to go ahead and give it to you. Now, in the properties for the shared folder, enable shadow copy. You won't be able to do that on that folder, but you can in the properties for the volume enable shadow copy for the volume. It's not the second one. This is a typo. That's actually the middle one. So in the properties for the volume, enable shadow copy for the volume. Okay. Configuring Hyper-V, and I don't know if I'll be able to get into the demo piece, but configuring Hyper-V, it covers the dynamic memory, you know, just smart paging, resource metering, things of that nature, talking about what I need to do to set up the Hyper-V infrastructure and manage it when I actually get into the console itself, into the actual GUI itself. So this section covers that quite in detail. Things to keep in mind. What are the requirements? 64-bit systems, making sure I have Intel V or AMD V technology. Many of you guys may already know this already. And just making sure that that BIOS or the UEFI infrastructure, backbone has an understanding of what the virtualization hardware requirements are and making sure your system is DEP enabled. Now, if you can see this, it just talks. This is just a typical Windows Server 2012 R2 GUI of the management of a server. And in there, what you'll see is the options to enable things like dynamic memory. Dynamic memory is the ability to add memory to a running VM as needed so that you can actually expand the amount of space it's taking. You can add additional hard disk or hard drives. Have the option between SCSI and IDE. I believe IDE is kind of going away, and we're going to stick with SCSIs quite a bit. Another key thing to remember is the integration features. And when we start asking, what are integration features? Integration features are allowing that Hyper-V host to be worked with the Hyper-V guest itself so that it can use things like operating system shutdown, time synchronization, data exchange, heartbeat, and backup and volume snapshots. Okay, there are a number of other terms I won't go into, but NUMA, I'll just mention them. So non-uniform memory access, also important to know. It's not listed here, but also something to think about. Resource metering, what it does it do in terms of managing how much data is being, how much traffic is being sent across the network. Virtual machine chimney, basically offloading the traffic that's going to the virtual machines to the host system itself. And have that offload available. And then another one is SRIOV, single root IO virtualization, which enables the virtual machine running on the Hyper-V server to have direct access to the network adapter hardware itself. Again, these are terms that you'll be asked about, and you'll probably have to be, you know, just know them so that you know exactly what to select, right? Sometimes it's not always about what the answer is, it's knowing what the answer is not. Right, so that's why I'm kind of mentioning this to you, so that you're aware of this. Okay, I don't think I'll have time for the demo just because of the time, but so let's keep going. We have up to 2048 virtual CPUs. So Windows Server 2012 version Hyper-V contains just a number of improvements. So you can have up to 320 logical processes supporting 2048 virtual CPUs. Again, 4 terabytes of physical memory. One server can host up to about 1,024 active VMs, and a single VM can have up to 64 virtual CPUs and up to 1 terabyte of memory each, right? So when you're talking about a Hyper-V Hyper-V can also support clusters with up to 64 nodes and 8,000 VMs within that cluster. So huge improvements. Again, another key that I didn't mention in here is the PowerShell support, right? So PowerShell becomes a big deal. Make sure you know that as well. Let's go on to this next one. I'll ask one more practice question. Server runs Windows Server 2012 with Hyper-V role installed. A virtual machine VM named VM1 runs on the Hyper-V server. VM1 is configured to use dynamic memory. You need to change memory allocation settings for VM1. Which memory allocation setting cannot be changed while VM is running? Anybody know this one? Right off the bat? See? Did I hear it? Yep, startup RAM. So you can't change the startup RAM while the VM is running. You have to actually shut down the system and then change the startup RAM, and then you can move forward. Next section, core network services, right? So we're talking, what do I need to do to make sure I'm communicating on that network? This section really goes into your IPv, your IP addressing. So make sure you know your subnetting. This is a very important section. When you hit that section, they're gonna want to know that you understand, you know, how to calculate what your IP address is. Again, IPv4 versus IPv6. You're gonna get a lot more questions around IPv6 and understanding, you know, just how IPv6 works and it's the hexadecimal way of coding the actual address. Again, it goes from having a 16-bit address to 128-bit characters. And knowing the difference between a global unicast address and a link local address in the IPv6 network is also important, because the link local address, unicast address, is already assigned to that system. You can actually set the global unicast address. And just some of the tunneling technologies, knowing when 64 might be relevant. So in other words, having the ability to encapsulate the IPv4 traffic in an IPv6 network and transmit it across. Or if you need to have it internally with the ISOTAP, also being able to do the same. If you're going over the internet, thinking about using Teredo as another opportunity to kind of burrow through and get that traffic back to the internal network or back. So again, these are all tunneling technologies that you'll see with IPv6, with servers that are trying to talk to IPv4 servers requiring some sort of NAT64 or server that actually can do the translation and have that data sent over to them. I kind of gave a quick example of what that looks like over on the side, just so you're aware of it. These are tunneling technologies. You maybe ask questions just to understand what they are and what they look like. Make sure that you're looking them up. Deploying and configuring DHCP servers. I'm just showing you this because, yes, many of you probably work with DHCP. No, this is another thing that you want to pay attention to when you get to a point when you're actually configuring and making changes in the actual test exam. You'll have to know if your services are running and things of that nature. So DHCP, by default, you come with a lot of warnings already. So do a lot of the other technologies. Make sure you know what those are. When DNS covers a lot of the DNS requirements, the host, the record, the SRV records, the startup authority, and anything that has to do with DNS management, make sure that you're reviewing what they mean and how you would actually use it. And for example, AD integrated zones, forest DNS zones, domain DNS zones, and stub zones. All those are domain partitions that you probably should be aware of zones that you have to configure when you're dealing with DNS. The last piece on this one, understand the importance of root hints, right? What are root hints? Know your subnetting. When you get in there to take the exam, this is one of those that will test your subnetting skills. Know the difference between global and unique, global, unique, or local addresses, so that you know whether it starts with an FD00, and when to figure out, you know, what type of IPv6 address it is. They're actually encoded differently. And PowerShell is not the only way to configure DNS and DHCP. I didn't mention global names. Global names is sort of a replacement of WINS, right? So that was introduced back in 2008. Make sure you know what global names are and when you can actually use them. Practice question, just for time, because I'm flying through this now. Server runs Server 2012 with the DNS server roles installed. Server 1 is joined to the AD domain. Users that have computers joined to the domain are reporting that they are not able to resolve any server names. After troubleshooting this issue, you find that the DNS IP address configured on the client is different from the IP address of server one. You need to prevent the issue in the future. What should you do? Anybody know the answer right away? B, A, can I get a C? Can I get a C? Yeah, very close. It's actually C. So configure static IP addresses for client computers. And then you basically, you'll be able to have those addresses just basically available on the system. You don't have to worry about it going through. What? I'm sorry. Is it A? Configure. Have computers joined the same domain? It's actually A. Somebody did this wrong. It wasn't me. It was my buddy. It wasn't me. I promise. I'll talk to him when I get back. He got it wrong. Yeah. Frank, jeez. Totally. He's got it. Yeah. There's practice exams upstairs, but don't use the measure up ones. All right, let's keep going. Thanks for that tip, guys. Really appreciate it. I know what to do in the exam. Last two sections, AD, installing and administrating AD. Again, I do a lot less of conversation around what these require because many of you are AD admins. The things to keep in mind is PowerShell. PowerShell is king. It's relevant, so whenever you have to use it, make sure you're talking about it. Know the difference between ADS and AD lightweight directory services. A lot of times people get those confused. Also know your FSMA roles, flexible single masters of operations. Again, not so relevant in Server 2012 terms, but it's still something that they will probably try to test you on the exam. In other words, knowing where your PDC emulator is, knowing where your global catalog servers are, and any infrastructure master, whatever servers you need, make sure you know what they are. And again, DC Promo, as many of you probably know, is a deprecated feature. It's still available, but however, the suggestion is you use Server Manager to actually do the Active Directory install and walk through the process itself, or to use a PowerShell command that actually installs the DC Promo, installs the Active Directory infrastructure itself. A couple of commands there you can probably see to test the installation. And also the fact that you can actually do it from IFM or install from media, where you actually take that actual component and take it to a system that's offline and do the AD directory install that way as well. Okay, and so we also can create and manage Active Directory users and computers using the ADAC, Active Directory Administrative Center, which is different from the Active Directory users and computer. Again, a new feature that we're seeing with Server 2012. It makes life a whole lot easier, and it's much easier to work with. But DSA, remember, in the exam, they're going to want to know how much you know about ADAC, but also things like DSAD is still relevant. Things like LDIF, DE, which is Lightweight Directory, is still available. CSVDE is still alive. So those commands are still going to be available for you to use. But the key thing to think about is what kind of things will I be able to do in the ADAC? For example, managing passwords, password settings objects in ADAC. You have to do it there. And then two new features to think about is the recycle bin and the fine-grained passwords, as I mentioned just a second ago. Okay, and then again, same process. You probably already know much of this. Just distribution groups versus security groups, know the difference. A few more details around the ADAC, and just thinking about when you have to create OUs for decentralized administration. They'll ask you questions, when do I need to create an OU? And you'll be able to tell which OU needs to be created, which users need to have access to it. And you remember those questions. Sales group needs access to the HR group's data. I won't go to those. Don't go through those details because many of you probably have seen that quite a bit. Again, this is the new ADAC where you're actually going through and creating a user. You won't use the ADUC anymore, but at least you can see what it looks like. Get in there, play around with it, and just get familiar with what's required. Okay, let's try this one again. Let's give it one more chance. Let's see if MeasureUp knows what they're talking about. Currently, all domain controllers run Server 2008 R2. You install Windows Server 2012 Server. You need to promote the Server 2012 Server to a domain controller. You need to use the install from media option. What should you do? A, B, or C? B? B? Are you sure? Yeah, you got it. All right, good job. Yeah, that was easy. Upgrade one of the existing servers 2008 R2 domain controls to server 2012 first, and then create an install for media. Then you can upgrade the rest of them to 2012 as needed. Okay, last section, create and manage group policies. Again, it covers GPO links, it covers auditing policies, security options and templates, and also rules enforcements for like app locker and software restrictions. Again, we go into a little bit more detail in the next section about that. It also covers firewall policies and things of that nature. You talk about creating group policy objects, when you would actually do it. Again, this is all really around understanding when you would use different types of group policies and how you'd actually configure it, whether you're using it for and what types of group policy objects you're actually going to use it on. For example, domain group policies and or domain controller group policies, where you're actually making the changes. When and how you can link it to sites, domains, or OUs, and how to make sure that you can actually do it correctly, because you can't link them to users or groups or computers. It has to be linked to those domains or sites, right? So they're going to test you on that. They're going to want to make sure you understand what those are, and also how to create group policy objects. What's the process of creating it? And then lastly, app restrictions. I'm not going to go too much into detail, but just app restrictions, publishing it to users, assigning it to users, assigning it to computers, what you can do with it, and the fact you can actually remove software using it, and also the fact that it's AppLocker is available in Server 2008 and Win 7 as well. So just really quick on the key tips to know for key tips for group policy, remote GP updates available. That's, again, an R2 component. GP infrastructure support and support for Windows RT for group policy support. That's also available. And then you also have startup GPOs. So things to think about. Are these features, you know, they're not making it up. It's actually real features. Last test question. You're the system admin for medium-sized Active Directory domain. Currently, the environment supports many different domain controllers, some of which are running Windows Server 2012 and 2003. When you're running domain controllers in this type of environment, which of the following types of groups can't you use? So A, universal security groups. How many people think it's B, global groups? C, domain local groups? D, none. You can use all group types, and you guys are correct. You can use all the group types. You can actually use all of them. Great. So that's it. I just wanted to make sure, in review, we want to make sure we went over the certification overview that David did. I know we went over a little bit on the time, quite a bit, actually. And here are a few sessions that are coming up next. Guys, thanks for coming today. Hopefully you guys are prepared to take your exam. And I have a session right after this. I don't know if the times are still correct, but it's still coming up. So. By the way, there's an exam session. If you want to do practice exams, go to the third floor. Go to the third floor, and you can actually do some practice exams as needed.